Oh, hello?
There we go. Okay, time to get started. I was having a great conversation about the Lord of the Rings. Love to continue it and just leave behind examining arguments, a dialectic tool of teaching, which sounds so dry, thinking of Legolas and Gimli and Boromir and Lothlorien and Rivendell. If you're going to go to Middle Earth, where would you want to go? Where would you stay? Or at least where would you start? I've asked a lot of people that question. Where would you want to start? I want to start in Rivendell. I want to walk up to Elrond and say, what should I go see? Yes, what should I go do? And I'd be off. You know, Lothlorien would be a nice place to visit, but I don't think it's not human enough for me. You know, it's not down to earth enough for me. But everybody's in Lothlorien, elves and dwarves and everything else. But that has absolutely nothing to do, you know, it'd be neat to be able to segue that into examining arguments, but I can't. So, let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you very much for our time this morning. Father, thank you for Matt's encouraging talk. I pray that we'll take to heart what we learned there. Father, I pray also that you'd help us as we're looking at teaching students in the junior high years, teaching dialectic students. I pray that you would help us to be good teachers, to be skillful in what we do, to do it with all our heart, knowing that you're watching us and that we're serving you most of all. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, in my two workshops today, this morning and this afternoon, I want to be presenting a vision of teaching in a classical Christian school at the dialectic stage, in the junior high years, or what Dorothy Sayers calls the pert age. Specifically, I want to summarize what I see as the three main tools of dialectic teaching: analysis, examining arguments for their strength or their validity; discussion and debate. Analysis, discussion, and debate. This is partly in response to a suggestion that was made last year on a conference evaluation forum. Someone said, and maybe it was one of you, asked us, expand the how-to on the dialectic/logic end. Keep giving us a vision of what it looks like to teach at those stages. And so that's what I want to do. Classes at the dialectic stage will use class discussion, and they will use both formal and informal debates, and I'm going to go into detail on those in a workshop this afternoon. But dialectic teaching must also involve the analysis of logical arguments, analyzing arguments. What do I mean by an argument, by a logical argument? By argument here, I do not mean a heated disagreement or debate primarily. I simply mean a set of statements, one of which appears to be implied by the others. The one that appears to be implied by the others is the conclusion. The statements that appear to be implying the conclusion are called the premises. All men are mortal. Socrates was a man, therefore Socrates was mortal, is a logical argument, because the conclusion, Socrates was mortal, appears to be implied, and in fact is implied, by the premises that all men are mortal and Socrates is a man. So premise, conclusion, that's a logical argument, and specifically that's a categorical syllogism. There's a lot of types of logical arguments. That's only one of them. A categorical syllogism. And by analysis of arguments, I mean dialectic teaching involves taking an argument apart in order to make sure that it's a good argument, in order to analyze the structure and the form and the truth of it, and to see that the conclusion really is supported by the other information in the argument. Now, this is what dialectic teaching involves. Each of the classes in the dialectic stage, math class, English, literature, history, science, each of the classes must analyze the core arguments of their particular subject. Now, what do I mean by core arguments? The core arguments are those arguments which embody the essential lessons in the subject. Those arguments that embody the essential lessons in a subject. Consider the main points that you would make in teaching your particular subject at the dialectic stage, along with everything you would include to support those points, and you have the core arguments. Core arguments are the sine qua non, the without which not, of the subject. Arguments which, if they're not taught, that implies that the subject was inadequately covered. If you adequately cover your subject, you will include the core arguments. Now, here are some examples of possible core arguments for different subjects. And what I did to get these is I simply looked through our Logos School curriculum guide and saw those points which appear to be the most important points in the subject. For American history, one conclusion that the American history teacher wants to get the students to realize is that the colonies were justified in declaring their independence from the King of England. The colonies were justified in declaring their independence from the King of England. Now, the American history teacher would have to, if he's going to claim that, and that's a big claim to make, then he's going to have to prove it. And he's going to have to run through support for that claim. Now, in the grammar stage, maybe it would be enough to make that claim and explain what it means. But that's not going to satisfy in the dialectic stage. They're going to have to prove it. In New Testament, the claim is made that the New Testament cannot be properly understood apart from the Old Testament. Well, that's going to have to be proven by the Bible teacher. In Latin, the one point made is that translation is more than just a word-for-word substitution. Well, the Latin teacher will have to prove that translation is more than just a word-for-word substitution because the Latin student's going to want to do exactly that. The English teacher, all stories have a setting, characters, and a plot. Really? All stories, Mr. English teacher? Yeah, all stories have a character, setting, and plot, and they're going to have to prove that. In algebra, to solve for two variables, you need two independent equations. Now, algebra, if you don't teach that to solve for two variables, you need two independent equations, you haven't really covered algebra yet. It's one of those core arguments. Science, different species did not evolve from a common ancestor. Well, how do you prove it? Yeah, if you're going to tell me that evolution is not true when all the rest of the world is telling me that it is, you better be able to support what you're claiming. When such claims are made, PERT stage students will want them to be proven, since they want everything to be proven. And the claim plus the proof is what I mean by the core argument. Now, arguments which are not necessarily core arguments, which I call secondary arguments, should also be analyzed. Whenever a claim is made in class, which would cause a number of the students to ask, how do we know that's true? If that question is going to come up, either just in their heads or when they raise their hand and come out verbally, you should be able to prove those arguments as well, those secondary arguments. For example, the Battle of Thermopylae was a turning point in the Persian Wars. Okay. Well, they might say, well, how do you know that? First of all, they've asked, what does that mean? And then, how do you know it's true? The Earth has a core of molten rock, the Earth science teacher claims. Really? Have we been there? How do we know the Earth has a core of molten rock? Well, science teacher better be able to prove it. The speed of sound in air is about 330 meters per second. The area of a circle is pi r squared. Universal statements do not imply particular conclusions, or universal statements do imply particular conclusions. The logic teacher needs to be able to say one of those two and explain and justify his reasoning. The exodus from Egypt occurred around 1440 B.C., Really? I know people that say 1290 B.C. How do you know? Anne Bradstreet was the first significant American poet. Really? Were there other poets? You know, how do you know? What do you mean by significant? And so on. So those are types of secondary arguments that the teacher, though you could teach, well, look at all these and they look like primary arguments. I can imagine you teaching a science class without teaching that the speed of sound in air is 330 meters per second. Now, I think it's important, but I can imagine it being done. Okay. Different types of arguments will, of course, be analyzed differently. But there are two main types of arguments I want to cover quickly, deductive arguments and inductive arguments. Now, I covered this in my talk yesterday, but briefly, deductive arguments are based on universal statements, like all men are mortal, that deductive argument I gave. They're based on universal statements. And deductive arguments are either valid or they're invalid. Either the conclusion follows necessarily from the premises or it does not. That's what a deductive argument does. So the argument about Socrates being mortal was a valid deductive argument. And for a deductive argument to be valid, at least one of the statements needs to be universal. Now, inductive arguments, on the other hand, are based on observation. They're based on experience. Inductive arguments are either strong or weak, depending on how well those observations and experiences support the conclusion being drawn. The speed of sound in air is determined inductively. It's determined by experiment. Now, for some claims being made in the class, both methods can be used. For example, we all learned that in our science classes, in the absence of air effects, objects of different masses dropped from equal heights will land when? Yeah, same time, simultaneously. Okay? Now, if you read Galileo, and you should, if you read Galileo, he proves that in both ways. He proves it both inductively and deductively. He proves it inductively by actually doing the experiment. This is what he says. I, who have made the test, can assure you that a cannonball weighing 100 or 200 pounds will not reach the ground by as much as a span ahead of a musket ball weighing only 0.5 pound, provided both are dropped from a height of 200 cubits. Okay, fun reading. This is out of Dialogue of Two New Sciences. So he says he's done it inductively, and he's actually gone and dropped them both. But he also, that's not all that he does. He also proves it deductively. And he proves it deductively by considering what would happen if two different masses were connected together. And this is what he says. This is just brilliant. Assume different bodies do fall at different speeds. Okay? And what he's doing here is actually running through a procedure called a reductio ad absurdum. He assumes the opposite of what he's trying to prove and show that that leads to absurdity. Okay? And so he says, assume different bodies do fall at different speeds. If we take two bodies whose natural speeds are different, it is clear that on uniting the two, the more rapid one will be partly retarded by the slower, and the slower will be somewhat hastened by the swifter. But if this were true, and if a large stone moves with a speed, say, of 8, while a small stone moves with a speed of 4, then when they're united, the system will move with a speed of less than 8. But the two stones tied together will make a stone that's larger than that which moved at the speed of 8. Hence, we now have the heavier body moving with a speed less than the lighter, an effect which is contrary to the assumption. So he says, if a little stone fell at 4 miles per hour and a big stone fell at 8 miles per hour, then when you unite them, they should fall somewhat less than 8 miles per hour. But now they're heavier, falling at less than 8 miles per hour. See how it doesn't make sense? So therefore, we deductively see that they must fall at the same speed. And it's a brilliant argument, but what I'm trying to say here is that when we make claims in class, as Galileo was making this claim, he needed to prove it, and he proved it both ways, both inductively and deductively. Now, deductive arguments should be analyzed to verify their soundness. A sound argument has two properties. A sound argument is valid. The conclusion really follows from the premises, and the premises themselves are true, which means that the conclusion necessarily is true. All right. Now, when we begin to analyze core arguments, we have to then start with true premises. We have to make sure that our premises are true. There are lots of different methods for determining truth, and most people haven't thought through, how do I know that something is true? What do I use to prove that something is true? But there's lots of different methods for determining the truth of something. Reflection is one method. Sometimes we simply think about something, and we know upon thinking about it that it must be true. Your geometry teacher tells you that two points determine a line. If you have two points in space, one and only one line will connect the two if it's a straight line. And that's just something that we know is true upon reflection. Or matter occupies space. It's not something necessarily inherent in the definition or something. It's just we know it's true when we think about it. Now, there are very few things that are proved to be true by reflection, but there are some. Some things we know to be true by definition. When I make the claim that my father is a man, you know it's true. But I don't think anyone in this room has met my father. You haven't seen him yet. You don't prove it inductively. But you know it's true, simply by the definition of what it means to be a father. A father is a man. Some things are shown to be true by logical structure. When the Bible teacher makes the claim, well, Jesus was either God or he was not God, that statement is true simply by the logical structure of it. It covers all the possibilities. So, reflection, definition, logical structure. Some things are shown to be true by authority. Jesus will judge all men. Now, we know that Jesus will judge all men because the Bible says so, and the Bible is our authority. And I would make the claim that perhaps most things we believe on authority. It's certainly true when we're students. Your students believe that Paris is the capital of France, and they've probably never been there, seen the Capitol building or whatever. Okay, but it's a claim that's been made, and they don't have any reason to doubt it, and so they believe it on authority. You think that Pluto is a planet that's actually out there, and in fact, it's now the farthest planet, just past the orbit of Neptune. Why do you think that? You've never seen Pluto. You've seen pictures, that people have claimed was Pluto, but that's also belief by authority, right? And so we believe a lot of things on authority, which is also the same idea of believing it on faith. Okay, it's a faith issue. We believe some things by experience or induction. Young men like to argue. Okay, we all know that's true. But we know it's true because we have experience with young men. We see them or we've been them, and young men like to argue. And some things are true by deductive inference. Jesus is fully man and fully God. Now, that's you might claim that's true by authority because the Bible says that, but the Bible never says it in any one place. The Bible certainly says that Jesus was fully God, Colossians 2:9, and the Bible certainly says that Jesus was fully man. Jesus himself claims to be a man. But not in any one place does it say he's fully man and fully God. That's something that's arrived by deductive inference. By the law of conjunction. And so from the last two, induction and deduction, you see that sometimes the conclusions of other arguments are premises of new arguments. And we know that those premises of those new arguments are true because we've run through this sort of thing for those arguments previously. Okay, so we need to start with true premises, and those are some ways that we examine things for their truth value. Once we know that we're starting with true premises, we still need to verify that our reasoning is valid, meaning that the conclusions really do follow from those premises. Now, that can be done formally or informally. It can be done informally by sometimes simply by means of careful explanations, sometimes by drawing a picture on the board and showing, you know, here's how it works, here's how we know it's true. Or it can be done formally through methods of strict deduction or strict careful induction. And I'll give examples of doing that in a few minutes. Okay, so that's deductive arguments. Inductive arguments are analyzed to verify not their soundness, but their strength. Inductive arguments should be analyzed to verify their strength. An inductive argument does not lead to a certain conclusion, but only to a probable conclusion. So we don't analyze inductive arguments for validity because the conclusion does not necessarily follow from the premises. All inductive arguments, if they're purely inductive, are invalid. We can analyze them for their inductive strength. A strong argument is one in which the conclusion is more probable than a weak argument. For example, consider the claim that water always boils at 100 degrees centigrade at sea level, at pressure at sea level. Water always boils at 100 degrees centigrade at sea level. Now, you do the experiment, you go down to the beach, and you boil water, and you have your thermometer, and look at that, it boils at 100 degrees centigrade. You've done the experiment once. If that's all you had, it'd be quite a sweeping generalization to say water boils at 100 degrees centigrade at sea level. But you might make that conclusion with one experiment. But the good scientist always does more. So he does the experiment more and more times. And the more times he does it again and does it again and says, look at that, every time I do it here at this beach, it boils at 100 degrees centigrade. But there's other ways to strengthen it. The more differences we include that don't affect the outcome makes the conclusion more certain. So if we not only went to that beach, but then we went to a beach on the other side of the country, or maybe in another country in another spot in the world, and found out that, sure enough, on the island of Rhodes, when I boil water at 100 degrees centigrade, or when I heat water at 100 degrees centigrade, it boils, just like it happened in Cincinnati. Well, then you have an even stronger conclusion, when the differences don't make a difference, when these things besides the location. And then it's also strengthened when you do change something that's part of your theory. Move away from sea level. And if you move away from sea level and find that, sure enough, the moment I move away, it does change. You know, I go up to the top of the mountain, and now it boils at only 98 degrees centigrade. Okay, that even strengthens my argument further. And so there's ways of making the conclusion more strong. Now, logic, as the key exercise of the dialectic stage, teaches those methods of analyzing arguments. So this means that when your students learn logic, they will be able to follow the analysis of core arguments. It also means that the teachers at the dialectic stage should have a working knowledge of the techniques of logic. If you're teaching junior high, you should study logic. Okay? We are classical Christian school teachers. You need to study logic. Okay? Especially those techniques that apply to your particular subject, which is going to be most of them. All right? Now, before I leave induction to deduction, let me mention the strengths and weaknesses of each method. The conclusion of deductive arguments are contained within the premises. And that's both a strength and a weakness. It's a strength because if the argument is valid and the premises are true, then the conclusion must be true. It has been proven to be true. It's guaranteed to be true. But the fact that in deduction the conclusion is contained within the premises is also a weakness because it means that the truth of the conclusion is only as certain as the truth of the premises. If you doubt your premises, you've got to doubt your conclusion as well. It also means that deduction can't get you very far. It doesn't work with chairs in this room. If I looked at every chair in this room, every single one of them, and said that they, I don't even know what color that is. What color is that?
Adobe?
Okay, if I said every chair in this room, I've looked at every single chair in this room, and they're Adobe colored. That's the chair in this room, therefore that's Adobe colored. Now my conclusion is certain, but it hasn't gotten me very far. Right? I already knew that because I knew that every chair in this room was Adobe and that's a chair in this room. So that's Adobe colored. I've learned something new today. Now, the conclusion is certain, but it's trivial. And so that's it's a strength and a weakness. The conclusions of inductive arguments go beyond the premises. That's also a strength and a weakness. It's a strength because we can make a universal conclusion based on a few experiments. I can conclude inductively that water boils at 100 degrees centigrade on the shore of the Mediterranean, even though I've only boiled water in Cincinnati. I can make that conclusion. But it's also a weakness because I cannot be absolutely certain. I haven't tried it. And that's the weakness of induction. Einstein said it well. He said, "All the experiments in the world cannot prove my theory to be true, but it would only take one to prove it false." And that's the strength of induction as well as the weakness of it. All right. We should recognize that different subjects will analyze their core arguments in different ways. We prove things differently in Bible than we do in physics. So I want to start with the easy case, the case of geometry. Now, I would start with logic, but some of you may not have taken logic, and probably all of you at one time or another have taken geometry. And the analogy is close enough, and it's a familiar one. Geometry provides us with a good model of how to go about proving our core arguments of our subject. Euclidean geometry starts with a set of assumptions. It starts with some undefined terms, point, line, and plane. It starts with some defined terms. Collinear means lying on one line and that sort of thing. And it starts with some postulates. Postulates are statements about those terms, defined and undefined terms, statements about those terms which are assumed to be true. Like two points determine a line. Okay, statements that we just assume to be true upon reflection or whatever. Now, those starting points are the grammar of geometry, which are then expanded using the rules of strict deductive logic. From those few assumptions, geometry proves theorems, which proves other theorems, which proves other theorems. They prove theorems which are used to prove all your further theorems, and the theorems of geometry are shown to be valid deductions from the premises which we assume to be true. Now, if you look at Euclid and Euclidean geometry, I mean actually what Euclid wrote, not a modern geometry text, he was able to start with a few definitions and 10 axioms, and in the first of his 13 books based on those, he proved 48 propositions, starting with three simple constructions that you can construct an equilateral triangle and so on. Moving on to theorems like side angle side for congruence, and ending with, the second to the last one being proving the Pythagorean theorem, that if you have a right triangle, then the square of the legs, the sum of the square of the legs is equal to the square of the hypotenuse. You know, that theorem we all learned in geometry. Okay, and starting with those few things, he was able to prove that, and we know it's deductively certain. Now, different subjects will follow a similar procedure to prove their core arguments. Let's consider Bible. You're teaching a doctrine class, and one core argument is certainly the doctrine of the Trinity. You make the claim that one God exists eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And the perch stage student raises his hand and says, "How do we know that? Prove that." Well, you say, the Bible is infallible. The Bible is true in everything that it teaches. Now, that's either a postulate, something that you assume, say, we are Christians, and that's what we assume. Perhaps you prove it later in apologetics. But we make the claim that the Bible is infallible. And then we say, and the Bible teaches that one God exists eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Therefore, it is true that one God exists eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, does that satisfy the Perch Stage student? No, of course not. They'll say, where does the Bible teach that there is one God who exists eternally in three persons, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? Okay, so you say, well, the Bible teaches that there's one God. It teaches that here in Deuteronomy 6:4, and here in Isaiah 45:5, and here in 1 Timothy, and so on. And the Bible teaches that the Father is eternally God, the Son is eternally God, and the Spirit is eternally God. Is that satisfying? No. Okay, prove to me that the Bible teaches that the Son is God. Prove to me that the Bible teaches that the Spirit is God. I heard from my neighbor that the Spirit is simply God's force, his active power, and not a separate person of the Trinity. How do you prove that? So you go, okay, well, in John 14, it says that the Spirit speaks and hears and teaches and reminds and does things that persons do. And in 1 Corinthians, it says that he has will and a mind and determines things and that he commands apostles in Acts. And you run through and proving that the Spirit is a separate person. And you run through those arguments. And you keep doing that, getting deeper and deeper, until the students are satisfied. Or at least until they should be satisfied. Okay? And then you go on. Okay. That's the same sort of procedure. Now, in Bible, you see that it's based on primarily on authority, but also on deduction. You're doing deduction based on your authority. In fact, the Bible teacher has an advantage over every other teacher. He knows that his premises are true, without doubt. Now, the other teachers, you know, there's always some, you know, you're teaching history. And there's always some doubt that maybe what we've learned about Jackson during the war wasn't quite true. Maybe that's a story someone made up. But you know it's true in the scriptures. Okay, the science teacher. Many of the core arguments in a science class, of course, are proven using the scientific method. You've got your observations leading you to a hypothesis. Your hypothesis is tested with controlled experiments. From those experiments, you make conclusions. They're hopefully repeatable. And that's the scientific method. And you see that the scientific method is a special kind of induction, a special kind of inductive argument. Now, often, the science students do experiments to verify that something that they've been told is true, belief by authority, is indeed true, you know, belief by induction, such as the speed of sound. You know, they probably learn first that the speed of sound, and they might not. You might do it differently. You might do it inductively first and then say, and look, the textbook agrees with us, hopefully, if you do the experiment well. Or you might go the other way. They might simply learn that the speed of sound in air is 330 meters per second. And then you say, okay, let's design an experiment that goes about proving that. So you have it proven inductively and deductively. Much of my physics class, I teach physics in our senior year, much of it's occupied with proving something deductively and then verifying it inductively. We derive some mathematical formula deductively. We derive Bernoulli's equation or something. And then we go about trying to verify that inductively by doing experiments. And there's great advantage to deduction sometimes. I think it's Kepler's laws. Kepler says that if you take an orbit of a planet about the sun, that the period, the square of the period is the cube of the mean distance of the planet from the sun, something like that. I think that's right. And he proved that inductively. He had all the data for the periods and all the data for the distance and he messed around with all these numbers until he found out that this always seems to be true in every case. And it took him, months or years in analyzing it and trying different things before he finally, ended up with this neato conclusion. And that's an inductive approach. And then Newton comes along with his theory of gravitation, and I'm able to show with the students that if you start with Newton's theory of gravitation and the equation for centripetal force, we're able to deductively prove what Kepler came up with inductively. We're able to do it in a matter of minutes. What took him months or years of observations and attempts and trial and error to show inductively. So there's that advantage of deduction. Okay. Some of the core arguments of a science class will be proven by other people's experiments, which are simply read about and discussed. You'll teach your students that gravity can bend light waves. they're probably not going to do an experiment to prove that. It'd be neat if they did, but they're probably not. Or that the center of the Earth is a core of molten rock. You're going to have to say, well, people did this. Or nothing can exceed the speed of light. Well, you're not going to do an experiment to prove that nothing can exceed the speed of light. You can't. That has to be a deductive kind of thing that they simply read about, because a high school student will not be able to understand Einstein's proof for that. It's too much math. Okay, literature. Literature may prove many of its core arguments by definition. A lot of proofs simply by definition and then by example. All right, consider my earlier core argument that I mentioned. All narrative stories have a setting, characters, and a plot. I got that out of our curriculum guide. Well, I went and grabbed our Warner's English Grammar and Composition, the book they got that from, and I wanted to see how does this book go about proving that all stories have a setting, characters, and a plot. And this is what they say. Setting, under setting. Every story happens somewhere at some time. That's their proof. Okay? And then they give examples, and one of the examples is O. Henry set most of his stories in New York in the early 1900s. Now, that's probably going to be enough to satisfy a student, because they know that if you don't have a setting, in some way, you really can't have a story, even if your setting's an imaginary one, like Flatland or something. So every story has some sort of setting. And that's then they talk about what a setting means. Every story happens somewhere at some time. And so it's sort of a proof by definition. Characters. Every story has at least one leading character. That one they simply seem to leave assumed. Although they imply later that it's part of the definition of a story. A story must be about someone doing something. And so they seem to make it part of the definition. And then plot. A writer can set a group of characters somewhere at some time and still not have a story. Something has to happen. So they seem to prove that one with sort of this reductio. You know, if it wasn't true, you wouldn't have a story. You need to have a story, therefore it must be true, and which is also kind of a modus tollens type argument if you've studied logic. And then they give an example of a story about a girl who drops out of school, wanders around a city, gets lost, returns home, determined to finish school. Okay, so they give this example. And you see from that, sure enough, the student is supposed to see that every story needs to have a setting, characters, and a plot. Now, such a proof may or may not satisfy a pert-age student. So if you're going to make that claim that a story must have those elements, you better be able to back up your must, that a story must have those elements. And one way you can do that is simply, for the student who asks, simply ask them, well, can you give me a counterexample? Can you come up with a story that doesn't have characters, setting, and a plot? And that will probably satisfy them, because they won't be able to do it. All right. History. The history teacher. History may prove its core arguments by induction. Simply people who were there who told us, and so that's also proof by authority. And they consider cause and effect. They look at the inductive cause and effect, and they also will be considering definitions. All the different subjects, of course, will be considering definitions. Some of those, the proofs will be based on definitions more than others. Say they make this claim: the Battle of Britain was the turning point of World War II. Yeah. Well, how do you prove that the Battle of Britain was the turning point of World War II? Now, the truth of the claim turns on the definition of turning point. Sorry, no pun intended. How do you define a turning point? What is a turning point? Well, what was the situation before the Battle of Britain? What was the situation after the Battle of Britain? The Battle of Britain was the turning point because at that point the English won. And if the English had not won, then the Germans would have controlled the Atlantic sea lanes. The United States would have had to fight the war then across the ocean instead of fighting it from England, and so on. And each claim you seek to verify and prove in order to satisfy the pert stage student. You seek to do that. All right, language. Language may prove its core arguments by example or sometimes by analogy. Just a few examples I think would be needed to prove that a good translation from the Latin is more than just a word-for-word substitution. That can be proven by example pretty quickly. You can give an example of a translation where it works word-for-word, a simple word-for-word substitution, and then you can easily give an example where it doesn't work very, very nicely, something where the verb is at the end or something. All right. The logic for the different subjects will probably not be as strict as the logic of geometry. When you're deriving, when you're proving your core arguments, it's very, very strict in geometry. It's very, very strict in math. Math just doesn't let you get away with anything. Logic is the same way. But in other classes, some things will simply be left assumed. Some trivial deductive steps will perhaps be skipped. It would be awkward and I think unnecessary for every class to follow that strict deductive approach of logic or geometry. But whatever the method, all Purge Stage students should see it being done and should practice doing it themselves. They should all practice analyzing the reasoning that's supporting the foundational truths of all the different subjects they're studying in the Purge Stage. The foundational core arguments basically should be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. We can have that beyond the reasonable doubt criterion. Classes should also examine the popular errors within their particular subject. The teaching of most subjects not only includes teaching the main points that you want to prove to the students, but also teaching the errors that people have made about that subject in the past. And we learn how to do this from logic also. Dorothy Sayers says, and I think she's right here, "Indeed, the practical utility of formal logic lies not so much in the establishment of positive conclusions, which is what we've been talking about, as the prompt detection and exposure of invalid inference." Now, an argument can go wrong in two major ways. The premises can be false, or the reasoning can be bad, either inductively weak or deductively invalid. If the premises are false, it doesn't matter whether the argument's valid or not. You can't be sure of the truth of the conclusion if the premises are false. So, what are some errors that have been made? Well, in Bible, one false premise that's been made in history is that Jesus can't be both man and God, that it's some sort of contradiction. Well, that error has led to various heresies, and a good Bible teacher, a good doctrine teacher, would go about and spend some time analyzing those heresies. What follows if we deny this premise? In math, for example, it was once argued historically that the square root of negative numbers is a meaningless concept. How can you have a square root of a negative, they say? Well, that prevented the development of many types of very useful mathematics that we now depend upon in our engineering and in electronics and so on. Similarly, if we were to deny that infinity was a meaningful concept, say infinity, it's meaningless, like the Greeks did for a long time. If you deny that, you can still have a consistent mathematic, but it can't have calculus. Calculus assumes that infinity is a meaningful, useful concept. In science, the classic example of an error in science is, of course, the geocentrism, that planets and the sun orbit about the Earth, and the Earth doesn't move. Now, that led to many false ideas about our solar system, and it got more and more complicated, Ptolemy's system, until it was this big, massive monster that Copernicus came and said, now, you can actually look at it much simpler if you assume that the sun is at the center. There's a lot to that argument. It's really an aesthetical argument. It's a simpler system when we assume that the sun is at the center. A lot of S's in that sentence. It's a simpler system, and therefore we assume that it's true. That's an interesting way to go about proving something. Anyways, in whatever subject you teach, you should examine errors that have been made in that subject. You should say, well, this thing was once taught, but we now know that it was not true, and this other thing is true, we now believe. Yeah. That sort of thing should be done in every single class. And some classes, like science, will do that more than other classes, like Latin. Well, so that's the truth of the premises. How about invalid inference? Formal fallacies are somewhat rare in teaching. Most people don't make formal fallacies, but they still do occur. For example, science sometimes affirms the consequent. Affirms the consequent means they run through this sort of argument. If P, then Q, Q, therefore P. If P, then Q, Q, therefore P. Now, the example I gave yesterday in my talk was, if there were an invisible cat sitting on this podium, then you couldn't see him there. You can't see him there, therefore there's an invisible cat sitting on my podium. Now, we know that that's invalid. And yet, it's the same sort of argument as saying this. If mammals evolved from a common ancestor, then they would have common characteristics. Mammals have common characteristics. Therefore, they must have evolved from a common ancestor. That's deductively invalid. and it's easy to show that it is. And that's one error that has been made in the teaching of science. Now, at the same time, we need to be careful because that sort of procedure is an inductive sort of procedure. You know, if water boils at 100 degrees centigrade at sea level everywhere, then it's going to boil at 100 degrees centigrade on the shore of the beach in California. It boils at 100 degrees centigrade on the shore of the beach of California, therefore it boils at 100 degrees centigrade everywhere. Same argument. But that's an inductive argument, not a deductive one, and so we run about proving that inductively. But we can't say that it's deductively certain. And so we need to make sure we understand the difference between those. So there are formal fallacies in teaching, and sometimes you'll run across those formal fallacies, and you need to be familiar with them. Informal fallacies are far more common, however. Informal fallacies are things like ad hominem, where instead of attacking the man's argument, you simply go after the man himself, attacking the man. Or the fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc. That means after this, therefore because of this. Because one event follows another in time, it therefore must have been caused by that event. Because B follows A must have caused B. Well, that's a fallacy. Just because one event follows another in time, it's not necessarily the result of the first. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century was not necessarily caused by the Enlightenment of the 18th, even though it followed it. You need to include more to prove that that one caused the other. Otherwise, you make the fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc. Science can fall into numerous informal fallacies. Ipsy Dixit, for example, an illegitimate appeal to authority. He said it himself, Ipsy Dixit. Although a lot of things we believe based on authority, the conclusion does not necessarily follow from the premises. Even when a genius makes a claim, it doesn't follow that the claim is necessarily true. Geniuses have been wrong. Aristotle was wrong when he said that things that are heavier fall faster, even though he was, I believe, a genius. Carl Sagan was a brilliant scientist in his area, but there's not necessarily life on other planets just because he claimed there was. That's an Ipsy Dixit. The book Defeating Darwinism by Opening Minds by Philip Johnson identifies a number of different fallacies in evolutionary thinking. He talks about circular reasoning, he talks about the straw man, and so on. And that's a good book to consider if you're teaching that sort of class. The Bible class should also consider fallacies of biblical interpretation. One book that I've read called Exegetical Fallacies by D.A. Carson is a good book for looking at those sort of informal fallacies made in a Bible class, in biblical interpretation. He says at the beginning of the book, I'm going to offend you sometime in the reading of this book because you're going to hear something that I'm going to call a fallacy that you've been taught. And so he starts by identifying one of his own arguments and that he'd given in the past and showing how that's wrong. You know, for example, one of the things he mentions is called the root word fallacy. Just because we know the etymology of a word does not necessarily mean that we know that the word actually means that. Yes, angel comes from angelos, which is messenger, but is an angel merely a messenger? Is that all the meaning of it? No, there's more to it than that. An apostle is more than one who is sent, even though that's the root word of it and so on. It's called Exegetical Fallacies by D.A. Carson. Another book by John Frame called The Doctrine of the Knowledge of God includes a chapter on logic, which meant I had to buy it when Krishlak showed it to me. Doctrine of the Knowledge of God by John Frame. And he discusses fallacies made in biblical interpretation, but Frame does something different than anybody else I've ever seen. He talks about the value of informal fallacies and how we use them in a positive way. It's really an interesting discussion. I appreciated what Frame had to say there. So, if you're teaching a Bible interpreting class, then you need to consider those books. In Latin certainly has the fallacy called chronological snobbery. Chronological snobbery is prevalent in any language class, any ancient language class. Latin is a dead language from an ancient culture, and so it does not need to be taught. Chronological snobbery is the best response to that claim. Just because it's old doesn't mean it's bad. Does a multiplication table wear out because it's old? No, it doesn't. Now, there's more to that in Latin, and you should be able to support the teaching of Latin. But but it doesn't make it useless just because it's old. That's a fallacy. So there's lots of informal fallacies that are made in the different subject, and you should be familiar with the names of the informal fallacies so that you can point those out when they're made in class, or point out how they've been made in the past as that subject has been taught throughout history. Now, when we follow this dialectic tool of teaching, then I believe we are using subjects properly. We're using our subjects for what they're there for. The students are learning the most important material in that subject. They're learning the grammar of the subject. In our teaching, if we concentrate on analyzing the core arguments of our subject, it'll help the teacher and the student from being sidetracked into peripherals. You know you're teaching what you claim to be teaching. You've told your parents that you're going to teach these things, and when you analyze the core arguments, you're actually teaching those things. And so you're doing what you've said you would do. And that's a value of this method. But at the same time, the students are learning how to think through their subject. They're learning how to think about their subject. They're not merely being given facts. They are exercising their minds on those facts. A pile of bricks do not make a house. A load of facts do not make an education. The facts need to be analyzed. They need to be supported. They need to be put together in some sort of structure. And that's what analyzing arguments does. It builds those bricks into a house. That way, they're not only learning their subject, they're learning how to learn. They're developing proper habits and proper disciplines of learning, which, if done effectively, will turn them into lifelong learners. It's very easy as teachers to let ourselves be content-driven. In the dialectic stage and the rhetoric stage, we have to continually fight being content-driven because we're learners. Good teachers are always learning new content in their subjects. They're always reading new books about their subject. If you're teaching history, you're going to be reading history. You're going to be learning things that you want to teach your students. And you'll learn more and more and more, and there'll be more and more content that you want to get into the minds of your students. Well, resist that temptation. Don't resist the temptation to teach them new things that you're excited about, but resist the temptation of thinking, I have got to teach all of this content or I haven't taught them history. Now, there are some core arguments that, yes, you do need to teach, but you don't need to teach everything. You need to teach them how to think. The teaching of content, even when it's content found in a great book, is not the whole of a classical education. Mortimer Adler said this very well. He said, although the great books introduce every subject matter into this scheme of education, its aim is not a mastery of the subject matter, but the acquisition of discipline. In a similar vein, Dorothy Sayers wrote, the tools of learning are the same in any and every subject, and the person who knows how to use them will, at any age, get the mastery of a new subject in half the time and with a quarter of the effort expended by the person who has not the tools at his command. To learn six subjects without remembering how they were learned does nothing to ease the approach to a seventh. To have learned and to remember the art of learning makes the approach to every subject an open door. Proving the core arguments helps students to learn the art of learning, how we know that what we're teaching is true. All right, so what do you need to do as a teacher? If you're teaching students in the dialectic stage, you must first develop the core arguments of your subject. Before the school year starts, you should identify all the core arguments of your subject. There's perhaps 20 of them. And that's, that number, of course, can vary widely in the different classes. You should write out in summary form not only what you're trying to prove, but the proof that you will run through in proving that particular point. Consider how you go about leading your students in an analysis of the core arguments. How are you going to lead them through that proof? Are you going to do it in a lecture? Are you going to do it through a discussion? If you're going to do it through a discussion, you need to know it inside and out in order to avoid those blind alleys and so on that they're going to lead you down. Also be prepared to prove the secondary arguments sometime before you present the lesson. You don't necessarily need to do that at the beginning of the year, but think through, before you teach a subject, what secondary arguments am I going to bring up, and am I able to prove those as well? Think through, before you teach it, how are you going to prove it? But before the school year starts, you need to think through all your core arguments so you have a map of where you're going to go over the course of the year. Similarly, you need to be ready to explain the errors within your area of expertise that have been made in the past. Identify the major errors that have been made in your subject, you know, 2 or 3 or 5 or 10 that have been made in your subject in the past. Identify those major errors. Determine what sort of errors they were. Were they simply false? Was the person misinformed, uninformed? Or was it an invalid inference? Is it a fallacy, a formal one or an informal one? Be prepared to explain how that error came about, and also how it's been corrected, and how you know that what you now teach is true. And then, if you're a dialectic stage teacher, study logic. Now, that's a long-term goal, but it's certainly something that we should be doing, because logic is what teaches us and our students how to think at the dialectic stage. And it doesn't teach us all the different types of thinking, but it does teach the thinking that's appropriate to the age of the student that we are teaching. Okay? Any questions, Paul? You can certainly start with any of the logic texts that are sold, like from Veritas Press, either the texts that we've written from Canon Press or Martin Cothran's Traditional Logic. Both of those will include all the sort of thing that I've been talking about. Or if you want something with a little bit more meat, there are some excellent books. One of my favorite is David Kelly's The Art of Reasoning with Symbolic Logic. That's an outstanding book, David Kelly, The Art of Reasoning with Symbolic Logic.